is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, well below the frost above, I am Micah Hanks, and this is the Grahamian Report, where not a moment has passed that we haven't been hard at work while the East Coast has been pummeled by a winter storm that has certainly been one for the books. And yes, we certainly have a lot of news to cover. Hope you guys are well and warm at home, wherever in the world you may be, as we broadcast to you our radio dispatches globally via the worldwide and world-renowned KGRARadio.com. On the match program, in addition to news, in addition to a bit of analysis of the state of affairs in the world of nukes, we're also going to be looking at some ominous incidents that involve unusual objects seen in our skies. And exactly what we're going to be talking about has to do with not only exceptionally large aircraft of unknown origin, but also incidents that involve multiple witness encounters, as well as possible supplemental information provided by radar and similar systems. In other words, the kind of stuff that really does seem, without a whole lot of speculation or additional effort, to indicate that there are strange and at times ominously large things operating in our skies. But what are they? Are we talking about stealth blimps being operated by government agencies, the result of black budget programs and the like? Are we talking about something that is even stranger than that? Well, we'll save the speculation for hour two, but certainly I think that there are some good facts and some very good cases representative of something unusual happening up there. But while we're here on the ground, speaking of unusual, the unusually couth and seldom ominous individual known as Race Hobbs, back in Master Control, our producer, Hubbo, how are you, sir?
Dandy.
Were you pummeled by the snow, the ice, the winds, and the power outages like many else were?
Negative. Now, it got cold. I mean, it's been cold at night, but we got up in the 40s today. And the weather forecast is, I don't want to lie to you, but I checked it just a little earlier. But sure, for us, we're looking at the 60s by Friday.
By Saturday, a day later, but nonetheless, yeah, we're going to see 60 on Saturday here. But let me tell you something. This winter storm, I mean, this was the real deal. There were at least 33 people that have at present been reported as having died as a result of this storm that pummeled the east coast of the United States. Of course, I think there were 9, according to the figures, in New York, 6 here in North Carolina. In the state of Virginia, there were 6. There were 3 in Pennsylvania, a couple in New Jersey, but, you know, they were experiencing flooding in addition to the winter weather. Even in South Carolina, there were 2. My friends in South Carolina were saying, we're not getting anything but rain down here. But nonetheless, the weather certainly hit them. There was 1 in Kentucky, 1 in Maryland, 1 in Ohio, 1 in Delaware, and 1 in Washington. And let me tell you something, Race. I heard just today that Mount Mitchell, the highest point east of the Mississippi, which is really just up the road from us here, Mount Mitchell got 66 inches between Thursday evening and yesterday morning.
Oh, goodness.
66 inches. I mean, if we were to tally that in feet, we're talking about, what, isn't that 5.5 feet?
That's up there.
That's a lot of snow.
Yes, indeedy.
It is a lot of snow, and it's looked like the snowy plains of Hoth above the bunker here. Never even had a power outage because of our fortified compound underground. And there were people who were even tweeting at me over the weekend wanting to know the answer to that enduring question. Micah, is your studio really underground? Well, if the fact that we didn't lose power and I was able to maintain productivity over the weekend is any indication, I'll let the listeners be the judge on that one. But yes, we were blessed here in the bunker, although there were a lot of power outages, a lot of strong winds, and other people in Asheville that were not as fortunate as we were. But, you know, I planned ahead. You know, Race, what I even did, I went out and I purchased some of those little battery sticks that you can use to charge a phone with a USB connection.
Uh-huh.
You know, I had some of those, filled up the gas tank in case I needed to be able to use the car for warmth in case we lost power. Filled the crock pot to the brim with homemade chili. and actually had everything set up so that if I needed to, on the power existing on my MacBook, I could actually use that and then use my phone as a wireless tether in order to connect to the internet and still be able to work at least a reasonable amount in the event that I lost power. Candles, of course, are a must to have on hand. And frankly, I don't think all those precautions were necessary because although we got a lot of snow dumped, I mean, we didn't get 60 inches here in Asheville. I mean, 66, again, was the record up there on top of Mount Mitchell. But down here in the lower lands, it was hardly that. Although I did hear that some of the upper elevations around the Asheville area got as much as 2 feet of snow. I mean, that's gracious. I don't remember that much snow since probably sometime in the early 1990s, I will say. I think it was the blizzard of 93 or 4. So this was significant, but still, I mean, it wasn't like, it wasn't exactly what a lot of people had expected. A lot of kids out there playing and tossing snowballs around and everything, but, there certainly were some people who were affected by this, whether just the hardships or, again, the 33 people who actually lost their lives as a result of factors related to this storm. So, indeed, we hope that all of you out there are safe, comfortable, and at home, and that you have weathered the weather, and I think the best way that one could possibly weather the weather. So there's other stuff that was happening over the weekend just as well, Race.
Indeed.
Like, for instance, I guess we had the relaunch of the X-Files for this kind of... Yep.
We did. It was... no spoilers here, but it was a great comeback for them, I think. I like the direction they're going with it.
I read reviews. I didn't watch it. That's the funny thing. Everybody's like, why don't you watch X-Files, Mike? I thought you'd be like the biggest X-Files fan. Never really got into the show.
Well, you never got into the Doctor until 5 minutes ago. Well,
funny enough, many more people...
People know you don't even have a TV.
Well, I only decided not... I do own a TV. Actually, I recently acquired one. I haven't even hooked it up.
Well, that's news to me. But like, I do know that you're not like a TV guy, I mean, I think you watch like Netflix and stuff like that maybe. But like, you're not, as long as I've known you, you've never really been a TV kind of a guy, It's not like I call you up, like I do, and you're, oh, I'm just sitting here watching, Friends or, Seinfeld or something. You're always working.
Well, I mean, here's my thing. Back when I worked in radio, because we would always have two or three of those monitors or television screens hooked up with the news stations on at all times. And if I was in the studio producing or hosting, for that matter, we would always have televisions with we'd have CNN, Headline News, Fox News. We had all the networks pulled up, and they were all reporting the same thing all day. It didn't matter, which one you pick. Pick your poison. There it is. But when I left working full-time in radio, I kind of made that decision. I said, I need to just kind of disconnect. I get my news online every day, and I'm able to filter what I look at, based on, Google or whatever else. If I want to go to a website, I get to at least pick what I'm going to. And I'm not glued to a television all the time. And I just decided about 5 years ago, I said, I'm not going to have a television at home, at least for a while. I didn't intend to stay that way for forever. But it's amazing that it's been 5 years and I haven't actually had a television hooked up in my home. Yeah, I'll watch something like Netflix for certain series or shows that I enjoy, or documentaries especially, which I really enjoy. I've always been a lover of films, but yeah. And I have watched, by the way. I mean, X-Files is on Netflix. I have watched it before, but it's a show I've never been able to get into, like Twin Peaks or Doctor Who. Or certain other programs. I don't know why. I think, though, I would probably speculate that for a lot of people, The X-Files is a fictional representation of the kind of things that often we discuss in a more serious capacity on this program. And for me, my serious interest in this kind of thing kind of trumps, I guess, a program that's kind of based on that, which you'd think would actually make that show more interesting to me, but that just has never really been the case. But I think, as with almost any show, you have to give yourself a little more time, right?
Yeah.
You have to give yourself a little more time. You sometimes have to watch an entire season before you really start getting into it. So
it's best to just go binge watch it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Start at the pilot and move your way forward. Don't cause yourself to miss out on any of the little crooks of the crannies. You know what I mean? That go along with finding all the little nuggets and knowledge of being a fan of a series.
Well, yeah.
The first episode of the 6-part series, everybody's saying it was around 13.5 million viewers. I honestly thought it would be higher than that.
Yeah.
Some are even saying that it was only that high because it followed an NFL, you know, championship playoff game. But when you compare the number of viewers at the X-Files height, which was around 27 million, 13.5 million is, you know, that's not, I mean, that's like approaching half of that. And I honestly thought that it, you know, there would be more people watching. It'll be interesting to see. Now, that number's not finalized the way I understand it. It'll be finalized in the coming days. But it'll be interesting to see, Micah, how it performs tonight in the part two of the pilot series of the 10th season.
Well, you know, here's the thing I've noticed. Using another show as an example, when Series 9 premiered on the BBC of Doctor Who last year, the BBC was reporting, unfortunately, much lower than expected numbers after the first episode aired, which, I mean, there was all this promotion, all this build-up, all this excitement, and then the numbers are just way lower than expected. And everybody's like, well, it must probably be that, you know, the general kind of fans out there who like the cute guy with the nice hair running around with the bow tie and everything, well, they're not going to tune in and be as interested in an older actor like Peter Capaldi. Actually, see, the numbers started picking up after they started counting downloads and people who were streaming the program via season passes on iTunes. In other words, again, just like podcasting has affected radio listenership in terms of people who tune in live, we see the same thing with the ability to stream on demand these television programs. And so in the old days, the only way you'd be able to watch a show like X-Files or Doctor Who or anything would be to tune in and catch that premiere. Nowadays, people don't necessarily have to rely on a television to be able to watch those programs, as is the case with me. I can use Netflix and I can watch a lot of these kind of shows on my MacBook or whatever.
That's right. That's a good example. Because for me, I didn't get to watch it in real time last night.
Yep.
I was actually working, so I couldn't watch it in real time. I didn't even get to watch the football game. You can bet that the first crack out of the box, I was running in there to watch it. But this morning I got up, I went to Amazon and I bought it because I want. I always buy the series, you know, that I like the most. I'll buy those episodes and keep them so I can go back and watch them again and find things in them that I might have missed or didn't catch when I watched it the first time.
Right. And speaking of catching things that we might have missed the first time, the public relations arm of our friends at the Central Intelligence Agency over the weekend, they were certainly cashing in on the X-Files hubbub. I'm sure you've seen some of this. I've noticed that the Metro, of course, the ever-reliable folks at WorldNet Daily, and many other news agencies have been talking about how the CIA has released their X-Files. Oh my God! The CIA! The CIA has their X-Files! Yeah, UFO files that they have allegedly released to the public. Hold on, we've got to get the... here we go. This is how you do this. Oh my God, the real X-Files have been released. There we go. No, actually, the reason I say, speaking of things we might have missed, is that, again, if you actually go to the CIA website, they have this blurb put up about this race. It says, the CIA declassified hundreds of documents in 1978. Yeah, detailing the agency's investigations into the UFO phenomena. These documents date primarily from the late 40s and 50s. And they said, to help navigate the vast amount of data contained in our FOIA UFO collection, we've decided to highlight a few documents both skeptics and believers will find interesting. Now, the reason that they did this was, again, because, you know, if you watch, and I've watched enough of X-Files that, I mean, I know the premise, and I also know the general ideologies of the two characters. You know, Mulder is the believer, Scully's the skeptic. And so the way that they put this on the CIA website, they said, below you'll find five documents that we think X-Files character Agent Fox Mulder would love to try and use to persuade others of the existence of extraterrestrial activity. We also pulled five documents we think his skeptical partner, Agent Dana Scully, could use to prove there is scientific explanation behind UFO sightings. And then, of course, they use that tagline, the truth is out there, click on the links to find it. And so some of the files that they link, here are the ones that they thought that Mulder would like. They said, flying saucers reported over East Germany, 1952. Second is the minutes of branch chiefs meeting on UFOs from the 11th of August, 1952. The third is titled Flying Saucers Reported Over Spain and North Africa in 1952. Survey of Flying Saucer Reports from, once again, 1st of August, 1952. And then finally, number five is Flying Saucers Reported Over the Belgian Congo Uranium Mines. Interesting that there'd be UFOs seen over uranium minds. And yes, as you might have already guessed, those precogs among our listeners in the audience, this one also dated to 1952. In fact, all of those files listed dated back to 1952. The ones that Scully had listed here, the Scientific Advisory Panel on Unidentified Flying Objects from January 1953, Office Memorandum on Flying Saucers, Memorandum to the CIA Director from 1952, and then another document from 53 that was the Office of Special Investigations Advisory Group on UFOs. You know, I mean, just, again, these have been around for years is the thing. This was just the CIA essentially kind of playing with the whole release of the X-Files. But there were some interesting things that appeared online over the weekend as well. One little memorandum that was actually touched on, which I went over a little bit for my subscribers on the weekend Graylian X podcast, was this article. And there was a gent who wrote for Network World, Michael Cooney, the writer, that lists the CIA's top 10 tips that they advise using when investigating a flying saucer. And they list, for instance, some of these. I won't go down the entire list because, again, it's really kind of the same sorts of things that we're already hearing here and fairly inconsequential. Now, I think they would be highly consequential if they were revamped, revised, and applied to a modern UFO research group, which I'll maybe discuss a little bit more in a minute in terms of my rationale for why they would be important in that regard, but I'll come back to that in a moment. So one, they list, establish a group to investigate and evaluate sightings. Two, determine the objectives of your investigation. Three, consult with experts. And they give a full rationale for all of this on each of these points. The fourth is, they say, create a reporting system to organize incoming cases. Five, a system also is needed to eliminate false positives. Six, develop a methodology to identify common aircraft and other aerial phenomena often mistaken for UFOs. And it goes on and on. But the reason I think that some of this, and actually maybe later in the program if I've got some time, I was actually bopping around over at the website of the skeptic Gerald Posner's website. And I was reading over some correspondence between Posner and Marcello Truzzi from I think there's a date that's actually inscribed on one of these PDFs I'm looking at here in blue ink by hand that dates it from December 31st, 1982. So this this document dates back to before my birth, but at least my last regeneration. But the correspondence, because it's not actually a file or anything, this was a letter to Marcello Truzzi. I mean, he was a sociologist. I think he was based in Michigan or Wisconsin. But he was a founding member of PSYCOP. He left the organization because he didn't like the direction it was going. He thought it was taking a too hard line of stance towards skepticism. But anyway, I was reading over some of these over the weekend and everything, and maybe we'll come back around to those later, but he puts out a similar justification for how we should define a UFO and how skeptics and believers alike can seek to try and understand what this phenomena, if anything, represents. And it's interesting because it seems that a few decades ago, that was something that more people on both sides of the belief and skepticism fence were amenable to, trying to find common ground on the UFO subject. These days, it seems that you either believe and you think that they're aliens and that the Space Brothers are looking out for us and that we've been visited and there have been crash retrievals and that all this stuff's been going on and that led to the creation of saucers that Bob Lazar reverse engineered at Area 51, which the breakaway civilization now is using to buzz around the planet and all this kind of stuff, and that the government has withheld all this information and that we have to get politically active to try and get it to be released, and that Hillary Clinton's going to be the candidate that'll do that for us, thanks to John Podesta, or there's absolutely nothing to UFOs. Move along. Now, if I had to guess, I would say that probably the truth lies somewhere in the middle. So if the truth is out there, okay, somewhere in the middle, it's this polarization that I think has really been, in large part, non-conducive to serious analysis and study of UFOs, except for, I think, a few notable circumstances that involve researchers like, for instance, Jacques Vallée, who I don't agree with on all points, but I think he has certainly been the person who's tried to be scientific, and before him, J. Allen Hynek had certainly tried to be scientific. Castigated, though he often is and was, by skeptics, I think he was a person who tried to maintain a scientific objectivity about the study of UFOs. And so anyway, over the weekend, it was kind of interesting because in addition to some of the historical points that I'm raising right here about UFOs that we saw flitting around as a result of the hubbub following the X-Files relaunch, we also had this document that was being linked around on the web, which was a unclassified historical document titled The CIA's Role in the Study of UFOs, 1947 to 1990, which Gerald K. Haynes, I presume probably a CIA historian, had had done a very good job, and actually in long form, breaking down the CIA's historical involvement in the UFO phenomena. So to an extent, yes, I mean, if you want to call that the quote-unquote X-Files, it's kind of a less impressive real-world counterpart, but most certainly it does, once again, underscore government interest and interest among these agencies in the serious potential that UFOs represent, whether that be a, you know, a scientific potential, a national security threat, you know, or any number of other things. Perhaps merely one of these great discoveries of our day, which many, I think, still hope that UFOs are, and that some, I think, as time goes on, feel a little less and less that they may actually represent. I am Micah Hanks, and this is, of course, the podcast you know and love as The Graylian Report, which we broadcast every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, live, whether sunshine or rain or, yes, blizzards about. So when we come back, we'll dig more into the news of the esoteric and the unusual. Stay right there. We'll be right back. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is The Graylian Report. Hey, follow me on Twitter, at Micah Hanks. You can tweet at me live when we're doing the live broadcast or any day of the week, anytime thereafter. Always glad to hear from all you guys out there. So here's a rundown of what's been going on in the news over the last few days. Now, life on other planets, of course, is something that we have already spent a good... Well, I don't know, really, depending on how you look at the UFO subject. Many believe that UFOs could be representative of alien life. Now, again, a long, many years of studying this phenomena, and I've stepped away, at least further back. I will always acknowledge a possibility, but it is merely that in my mind. I don't think that UFOs are therefore aliens. I think that's probably one of the best examples of a logical leap that one can make. But it certainly is something that various agencies, including the U.S. Air Force and its members, during serious scientific studies and analysis of the potentials UFOs may present, they have at least considered that. This is certainly something that many people consider. But life on other planets would likely be brief, according to scientists, and in likelihood become extinct very quickly, according to a new paper by astrobiologists at the Australian National University. Now, in research aiming to understand how life might develop, the scientists realized new life would commonly die out due to runaway heating or cooling on their fledgling planets. The universe is probably filled with habitable planets, so many scientists think it should be teeming with aliens. And this was according to Dr. Aditya Chopra, lead author of this paper, which was published in the journal Astrobiology. Now, early life is fragile, so we believe it rarely evolves quickly enough to survive. Chopra explains that most early planetary environments are unstable. To produce a habitable planet, life forms need to regulate greenhouse gases such as water and carbon dioxide to keep surface temperatures stable. The paper suggests that 4 billion years ago, Earth, Venus, and Mars may have all been habitable. However, a billion years or so after formation, Venus turned into a hothouse and Mars froze into an icebox. Now, you can see, obviously, that there are both natural and, in the case with Earth, probably also, those anthropogenic components that could lead to climate change on a planet. And some debate whether or not there are a mixture of both varieties of influence behind change that are occurring here on Earth. But obviously, as we can look at other planets in our solar system, there have been changes that occur over a very long period of time which lead to a planet becoming non-habitable. This paper suggests that 4 billion years ago, again, that there were many planets in our own solar system which may have been habitable, and that they no longer are. Early microbial life on Venus and Mars, if there was any, failed to stabilize the rapidly changing environment. According to the paper, life on Earth probably played a leading role in stabilizing the planet's climate. In other words, it was the fact that there was life on this Earth that led to the stabilization of the climate due to the interaction between the environment and the atmosphere and the biological life forms within it. So it's interesting because, again, this is one reason why many people, and they call this the Gaian bottleneck model, and people now think that this very well may be the model that helps explain any number of things, including why we have this perceived great silence. Remember, physicist Enrico Fermi had pointed this out in 1950. There were no signs of surviving extraterrestrial life to have been found. And even more than half a century later, we have yet to really find, at least in terms of our search out there. Astronomers, astrobiologists, physicists, we haven't found evidence. Again, the UFOs seem to be representative of something, but I'm not directly inferring that that's what that is evidence of. But I would guess that if indeed UFOs did represent aliens, that scientifically there should probably be good evidence for aliens just as well. So as you can see, there's a bit of a paradox, a logical paradox that arises from that. So it's interesting. It's certainly interesting. And the paper further notes that one intriguing prediction of the Gaian bottleneck model is that the vast majority of fossils in the universe will be from extinct microbial life, not from multicellular species such as dinosaurs, or of course humanoids, that take billions of years to evolve. So we very well may be extremely unusual, I should say, as far as life in our universe goes. But then again, I also would argue that we can only determine so much from the behavior of stars, you know, and the way that we can determine that there may be planets circling those stars based on, you know, minor observable differentials in the behavior of the light that those stars produce. And I think that when we're talking about, again, the nearest star, if we're talking about, like, what is it, Proxima Centauri, you know, still being a distance in terms of light years so far away that none of us in our lifetime could travel that distance. We couldn't traverse the space between us and the nearest locations in the universe where, again, possible habitable zones may exist. Well, we obviously need to take into consideration that maybe we are somewhat limited in our ability to find that life. Not that it doesn't exist, but once again, that based on even our most educated scientific models, there are obvious limitations present. And that does not deconstruct or degrade science, that merely observes and recognizes that we as a civilization, you know, we have a long way to go as a civilization. We do. We have a long way to go. Now, the question is, if this Gaian bottleneck model is correct, well, how close will we get? How far along can we progress before what some may already deem inevitable occurs? Difficult questions, indeed. In other news, apparently there have been hundreds of seabirds that have been found along an Alaskan coastline recently. There were dead seabirds, or seabirds, which scientists believe are signs that the ecosystem had been troubled by abnormally warm ocean water. Biologists like Tamara Zeller have been boating around Prince William Sound, scanning the beaches for dead and sickly birds. They also count that there are birds floating in the water in the area just as well as lining the shores. They can't stop at every beach. I think that one estimate may be as high as 100,000 in total, but the problem is that the groups, they can only stop on certain shores and they have to try and count what they can. An onshore total, for instance, had counted 284, while the total for that day had been in the thousands. So, again, the numbers vary, but the thing is that there is a disturbing number of birds that have been found. Actually, yeah, tell you the truth, there's another figure here. We have never found close to 8,000 birds on a one-mile-long beach before. It is an order of magnitude larger than any records we are aware of, so at least what they're saying that they have found right now is far greater in number than previous estimates of birds that wash up on shore or who have been found to die as a result of changes in the environment. It reminds us again how delicate biology can be. And if that isn't scary to you, take this one into consideration right now. There is a lake in Bolivia, Lake Pupo, and it was officially declared evaporated just last month. And let me tell you what that means. Hundreds, if not thousands, of people have apparently lost their livelihoods because this lake has just vanished. Now, high on Bolivia's semi-arid Andean plains, at more than 12,000 feet and long subject to climate whims, the shallow saline lake had essentially dried up before, but it had rebounded in years past just as well. At one point, it had completely dried up and then rebounded to twice the area of Los Angeles itself. But they say that the recovery this time around may no longer be possible. This is a picture of the future of climate change, according to Dirk Hoffman, a German glaciologist who studies how rising temperatures from the burning of fossil fuels has accelerated glacial melting in Bolivia. As Andean glaciers disappear, so do the sources of Pupo's water. But other factors are in play in the demise of Bolivia's second largest body of water behind Lake Titicaca. Drought caused by the recurrent El Niño meteorological phenomenon is considered the main driver. And authorities are also saying another factor is the diversion of water from Pupo's tributaries, mostly for mining, but also for agriculture. So more than 100 families now apparently in that area have reportedly sold their livestock. Yeah, they've gotten rid of their sheep and their llamas and their alpaca. They set aside their fishing nets. They've quit the former lakeside village altogether. Yeah. They say only the elderly remain, those who are not reliant on that location as a source of commerce. There's no future here, said 29-year-old Juvenal Gutierrez, who moved to a nearby town where he ekes out as a motorcycle taxi driver. It's pretty disturbing, but a 2010 study, apparently, that was co-authored for the Journal of Global Change Biology, had reported that Bolivia's capital, La Paz, could face catastrophic drought this century. It predicted inhospitable, arid climates would lessen available food and water this century for the more than 3 million inhabitants of Bolivia's highlands. Elsewhere, Florida Institute of Technology biologist Mark B. Bush said that the long-term trend of warming and drying threatens the entire Andean highlands. So while we're seeing that this obviously has an effect on the environment and that, you know, fowl, as we saw on the Alaskan coast, are affected by this, we're also seeing, again, a trend toward a vastly more arid environment in the Andean highlands than what we have seen in previous decades, such that, again, it's going to directly affect people and their way of life and their ability to sustain themselves. And we have to really take into consideration the kinds of changes that are occurring on this planet, as well as perhaps those which occur over time on other planets. Yeah, kind of puts one in a strange state of mind, at least in terms of one's existentialism. But anyway, you know, some people actually make the decision to put themselves and their lives at risk, and they do it, you know, in the name of science. One gentleman who did this recently was explorer Henry Worsley, and it's been reported by the BBC that he has died after suffering from exhaustion and dehydration during an attempt to cross Antarctica. Now, he was an ex-army officer, and those of you among the more intrepid or the explorer types in the audience, you may know of him. He'd been 55 years old, and he had been rescued 30 miles short of his goal of crossing the continent unaided, following in the footsteps of his hero, Ernest Shackleton. Now, in a statement, his wife Joanna said she felt heartbroken sadness. Mr. Worsley, from Fulham in London, died of complete organ failure. Mr. Worsley was trying to complete the unfinished journey of the aforementioned explorer 100 years after the fact, who will come back and discuss Mr. Shackleton a bit here in a moment. Interesting history involving that guy and other similar intrepid souls. My summit was just out of reach, Worsley said in his last audio message from Antarctica on Friday. When my hero Ernest Shackleton was 97 miles from the South Pole on the morning of January the 9th, 1909, he said he'd shot his bolt. And Worsley, in his final audio message, said, "Well, today I have to inform you with some sadness that I too have shot my bolt." Now, Prince William has said that he led tributes to Mr. Worsley, who was raising money for the Endeavour Fund, which is a charity which helps wounded servicemen and women and is managed by the Royal Foundation of the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge and Prince Harry. The Duke, who was patron to the expedition, said that he and Prince Harry had lost a friend as he paid tribute to Mr. Worsley's self-commitment to fellow soldiers. So, of course, this not only would be an achievement in terms of exploration, and, of course, following in the footsteps of Ernest Shackleton, but this was also something that was for a good cause just as well. Apparently, the Remark Group, which was also supporting Mr. Worsley's effort, said in a statement, "When Henry was picked up by Antarctic Logistics and Expeditions, he was suffering from exhaustion and dehydration. He was flown to a hospital in Punta Arenas in Chile, where he was found to have bacterial peritonitis." Yeah. Probably not a fun way to go down, but, you know, I mean, his courage is certainly something to be admired. He was described as being very energetic, very keen on testing himself, seeing how far he could get with his endeavors. I mean, he was 55 years old, which isn't exactly over the hill. In October, he had told the BBC he expected to lose 2 stone. That's roughly 12.7 kilograms during the challenge. He said his journey should take 75 days and he would take enough food for 80, adding, "I could make it last a bit longer if needed. What will drive me on is raising money for these wounded soldiers," he said. Now, you know, his what would have been, I guess, a historic trek had he made it reminded me of something interesting. And there was a guy, an author, a few years ago who wrote about this interesting facet of some of these explorers and the tales that they tell while they're out there in the field. The writer was John Geiger. And he had written about a number of people who have experienced unusual things while they're out there exploring. One of the most famous actually dated back to Ernest Shackleton's Antarctic expedition in 1916. The story goes that the team's boat was trapped in ice, and they were forced to make a grueling journey, of course, across mountain ranges and glaciers to a whaling station in Stromness Bay. Now, Shackleton later wrote, "I know that during that long and racking march of 36 hours over the unnamed mountains and glaciers, it seemed to me that we were 4, not 3. Now, later, the poet T.S. Eliot read Shackleton's account, in which he felt that there was another person, another member of their party, which did not exist. And apparently he included this idea in his famous poem, The Wasteland. And this is how that verse read: "Who is the third who walks always beside you? When I count, there are only you and I together. But when I look ahead up the white road, there is always another one walking beside you, gliding wrapped in a brown mantle hooded. I do not know whether a man or a woman, but who is that on the other side of you?" And hence this is where the name was derived that John Geiger, the author, gave this, the third man factor, as he called it. And again, it is that many people, when they are in a position where they are being pushed to the limit, experience feeling the sense that there is another individual there with them. And NPR had actually covered this story back in 2009, at which time they told a very similar story of a intrepid explorer who had felt the literal presence of an individual with him when in fact he was by himself.
British explorer Frank Smythe almost became the first person to ascend Mount Everest in 1933. He missed it by 1,000 feet, as he described it, at the very boundary of life and death. At 26,000 feet, climbers reach what they call the dead zone. There's not enough oxygen to keep humans alive, and during that expedition, almost all the other climbers never made it past the summit's base camp. But Frank Smythe carried on alone. In his diary, he recounted how, at one point on the ascent, he reached into his pocket to pull out a slab of a Kendall mint cake. He broke it in half and turned around to give the other half to a companion. But there was no one there. Here's what he wrote.
"All the time that I was climbing alone, I had a strong feeling that I was accompanied by a second person. The feeling was so strong that it completely eliminated all loneliness I might otherwise have felt."
I've always been fascinated by these stories where people believe that there is another individual there when in fact they were by themselves, as, of course, this story tells. But I will say this, though. There's another interesting parallel to all this that involves Shackleton. And rather than it being Shackleton himself, in this instance it was his ghost, at least according to Sir Edmund Hillary, of course, the man who would eventually go on to conquer Mount Everest. And he had actually said, and believe it or not, in a news item dated January 18th, 2005, Edmund Hillary had said that he had met the ghost of Ernest Shackleton. And under these circumstances. Now, he had gone to Shackleton's hut, which was there in Antarctica. And he said, "I remember when I first went to Shackleton's hut, and I'm not a person who really sees things very much, but I went inside the door. When I opened the door, it's a rather sort of bare hut inside, but I distinctly saw Shackleton walking toward me and welcoming me, and then it all sort of flashed away and he was gone." Yeah. Sir Edmund Hillary. And he goes on to say, "It's the only time I can ever remember something occurring like that, so I have a very warm feeling indeed for Shackleton and for his hut, and I really believe that those huts, Shackleton and Robert Falcon Scott's, must be preserved." I always thought that was so fascinating because, and again, what he was doing, he actually said this in a video that was promoting conservation work on Shackleton's former hut there in Antarctica. But he, yes, indeed said that he actually, despite not being someone who sees things like that, and you know what he's talking about, he says, I don't feel presences, I don't see ghosts, but he said, I saw Ernest Shackleton coming over to greet me at the door when I first went into that hut. Fascinating. You know, Sir Edmund Hillary has a bit more of a involvement in the unusual than just having claimed to see Shackleton's ghost. You know, you'll recall that back in 1962, well, maybe you won't, but I do because I'm a student of Fortiana, that there was an article titled Wintering on the Roof of the World. And it had to do with Sir Edmund Hillary's, not only his explorations, but his search for a particular anomaly while he was hanging around in the Himalayas. And there was a 1999 news article that National Geographic carried that actually referenced this, and it wrote, many expeditions have attempted to prove the Yeti's existence, but no scientific evidence has definitively confirmed it. Now, National Geographic's October 1962 article, Wintering on the Roof of the World, reports on Sir Edmund Hillary's search for the Yeti. The famed Everest Pioneer's expedition, which had other scientific goals, did document a phenomena that appears to account for Yeti tracks. In shaded snow, Hillary's team found impressions resembling fox tracks. The tracks led to a sunny area where melting had elongated the tracks into large human-like footprints. Likewise, the melting of tracks of a snow leopard, bear, or wolf could also create huge footprints. Over time, human footprints in the area have been seen to grow to nearly 21 inches. And it further notes that Hillary's team was shown fur purportedly taken from a Yeti. Investigation revealed that it was fur from the rare Tibetan blue bear. A Yeti scalp was analyzed and found to have been the molded skin of a sero, a goat-like animal of the Himalayas. Hillary returned from the Himalayas believing that the Yeti exists, but only in legend. I always thought that that was fascinating, that Sir Edmund Hillary, intrepid explorer that he was, also had a bit of history with the Yeti, among other things. And even if he didn't manage to find the Yeti, he certainly seemed to indicate that he believed that ghosts, well, at least one particular ghost, might indeed exist. Yeah, intrepid indeed. When we come back, we will continue our foray into the unknown here on the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Welcome back. In the final segment of this first hour of the Graylian Report, be sure and stick around for hour two, where we will be delving into the world of UFOs. And in the way that I tend to do, which is anything but conventional, at least by today's standards. That's right. And speaking of, as we're leading into that, I think this is probably the biggest headline that I saw today, apart from, of course, the non-news, the CIA releasing its X-Files, which it actually did decades ago, but oh well, you know, TV. So, yeah, there you go. Yeah, this one involves a purported nuclear incident and a possible Air Force cover-up. Okay, think about that for a moment. The AP in Washington reported apparently that in the spring of 2014, as a team of experts were examining what ailed the U.S. nuclear force, the Air Force withheld from them the fact that it was simultaneously investigating damage to a nuclear-armed missile in its launch silo caused by three airmen. The Air Force on Friday gave the Associated Press the first substantive description of the accident after being questioned about it by the AP for more than a year. The accident happened on May 17th, 2014, so this is pretty recently. And I guess that, I think that might have actually, yeah, that would have been after the publication of Eric Schlosser's book, Command and Control, which is about similar instances like this. And if you haven't read that book, it's extremely long, but I do own a copy, and I certainly recommend that to people. This incident occurred again in May of 2014 at an underground launch silo containing a Minuteman III Intercontinental Ballistic Missile, or ICBM. The silo, designated Juliet 7, is situated among wheat fields and wind turbines about 9 miles west of Pete's, Colorado. It's controlled by launch officers of the 320th Missile Squadron and administered by the 90th Missile Wing at F.E. Warren Air Force Base at Cheyenne, Wyoming. And what's interesting is that there's a bit of a history, according to Robert Hastings, about that location and some sort of an incident where there had been a shutdown, an equipment shutdown that occurred there, which he and others have alleged was representative of some sort of an object seen in the sky. Okay, but that's a different story. I just point out the fact that that is one allegation about that location. It would be interesting to see if there was anything in terms of the date of the two incidents, see if there was any kind of a reasonably similar period of time there. The Air Force said that while three airmen were troubleshooting the missile, a mishap occurred, causing $1.8 million in damage to this missile. The service declined to explain the nature of the mishap, such as whether it caused physical damage, saying that the information is too sensitive to be made public. The three airmen were immediately stripped of their certification to perform nuclear weapons duty. The missile was taken offline and removed from its silo. No one was injured, and the Air Force said the accident posed no risk to public safety. More than a year later, the three airmen were recertified and returned to duty. Now, at the time of the accident, a group of nuclear weapons experts were nearing the end of a three-month independent review of the entire U.S. nuclear force, an examination prompted in part by a series of AP stories on troubles within the force. The experts were operating on orders from then-Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, who asked them to begin their review in March. They reported their results to him in June of that year. Now, the AP asked Lieutenant Colonel John Sheets, spokesman for the Air Force Global Strike Command, which is responsible for the ICBM force, whether the May 17th accident had been reported to the Hagel-appointed review group. The experts were looking at a range of issues, including shortcomings in training, equipment, morale, and leadership. No, he said, the accident was going through the investigative process when the review teams made their visits to ICBM bases, Sheets said. Pressed further, he said, he could say no more and referred questions about this to the Pentagon, which did not immediately comment. Well, of course. The accident investigation board did not begin its work until August 25th, more than 3 months after the mishap. A safety investigation was begun sometime earlier. The Air Force denied an AP request for the accident investigation report in 2015 under the Freedom of Information Act. And so, yes, some people have been alleging that indeed the Air Force had apparently refused to make some of this public and therefore may indeed actually be covering up certain information. It says the summary said that the central cause of the mishap was established by clear and convincing evidence, but that the Air Force would not disclose the cause or the evidence. It said the cause is cited in the investigation report. The Air Force refused to make that public, saying the report is classified, even though the service's own policy requires the public release of accident board reports. So I guess the big takeaway here is that, yeah, at times, especially when there's something that seems like this little mishap shows worthy of being covered up, yeah, from time to time these agencies do withhold information from the public, even if it's something that under other circumstances it should be released. And when we come back, we'll try and touch on some listener emails as time allows, but we'll also jump right into a discussion of some very unusual reports of things seen in the skies. I don't know, is the Air Force or other agencies, perhaps are they involved in covering up this kind of information too? One may wonder. It is the second hour of this week's edition of the Graylian Report, where it is still frozen and snowy as much of the eastern United States has been for the last several days, but enough about that. Thank you for sticking around with us. All of you there in the chat room at KGRIRadio.com, and of course all of you listening worldwide around the globe on the internet via the podcasts we make freely available to all of the free world on iTunes and Stitcher and all the other podcatching clients where you can download these programs. Hey, be sure and check out the Graylian Daily News Service. That's right, daily, that we provide there at www.graylianreport.com. Follow us on Twitter. You can find Graylian Report on Facebook and like us there just as well. And finally, of course, if you're interested in learning a little bit more about what we do down here in the bunker, i.e., contributing to the great cause and also getting additional weekly content, do head over to graylianreport.com/X. You can sign up and become a Graylian X subscriber, in which case you actually contribute to the program. You're actually helping us out and you're getting additional content on a monthly basis just as well, such as the monthly specials we call Graylian Enigmas, something I've never done on this show before, but we're going to do this hour because it relates to the discussion we're about to have, which has to do with large UFOs, often multiple witness sightings of massive things in the sky. These are the kind of UFOs that are so large that they are, I would say, ominous in a lot of cases. We're going to look at some famous cases that involve those kind of reports, and in doing so, we will revisit at least a portion of one of the past installments of the Enigmas Graylian X programs, because I'd always wanted to do this, and I think it's been long enough. This episode probably aired a couple of years ago to subscribers. It involves, a famous incident, one of the arguably the strangest and also one of the most well-reported, both by the media and also recorded by government agencies, as you'll hear, that involves a UFO incident over the United States. And we're going to look into that, and in doing so, again, feature, for those who are not subscribers, kind of what you can expect with the monthly Graylian Enigmas program, which, again, is a slightly more, theatrical, storytelling-based kind of a program, whereas we do news and analysis on this show, as well as the weekly additional edition that Graylian X subscribers get. But do check that out, graylianreport.com/X. And finally, as I keep getting emails from people out there about the podcasting book, for those of you who enjoy not only listening, but you want to throw your hat into the ring and try getting into the podcasting thing yourself, you don't know exactly how to get into it, you can check out The Complete Guide to Maverick Podcasting. All of that information is available on the books page at my website, MicahHanks.com. All right, so the announcements are out of the way. I do want to very briefly get to a few listener emails, a couple of these having to do with the ufological kind of discussion we're about to have. Keith writes, "Micah, I love your podcast. Just started listening about a month ago. I have a story that's not elaborate like most, but it's a little odd. It might be nothing, and on the other hand, it might be something. So here goes. Now, I joined the Army in 1993, and after boot camp went to Fort Gordon, Georgia, to Signal Corps. Now, I was in communications, and without boring you the details on the technical side of things, my security clearance had to be high because of the sensitive nature of audio that we might hear coming through our lines. Now, one day, our commander made an odd comment. He was drilling us on the importance of not saying a word about what we hear, and don't share it with anyone outside our unit. Now, I'll be clear, Keith doesn't do that here. He's merely recounting something that his commander had said during this conversation, and this is what that was. He said, even if it's extraterrestrial in nature, you can't talk about it. Huh. Now, that seemed weird, but sadly, in all my time there, I never heard any such conversation. Anyway, thought I'd share that story. That is pretty interesting. It reminds me of one I was told a few years ago. And I will say that this involved an individual, formerly with the U.S. Air Force. He is intimately involved with this program. He has never been a guest on this show, but I would say that behind the scenes, he is involved on a week-to-week basis with the Graylian Report, and always has been since day one. And this individual, he called me one night, and this was actually off the air, but it was during a live broadcast of a program. We put him through on the telephones, and of course he didn't want his name used, as I will not use it here, but we called him Commander X on this instance. And he told me about an instance where, as a security clearance exercise, he was actually shown photographs of some weird object that allegedly had been taken via satellite that seemed to show something over Earth. He didn't know exactly what it was. He said, I didn't give the impression that this was anything alien or anything like that, but But he actually went on record on that radio program that night and said that whatever it was, you know, we were shown some interesting photographs. Well, just after he got off the air, another gentleman calls in and said, you know, I'm very familiar with the operation that the fellow's talking about there. And he referred to it as an operation because he said that sometimes low-level officers are shown unusual photographs. I don't know, this may just be hearsay, but this is what this individual called in response to Commander X's anecdotal story of seeing something weird in a photograph. He said, these kinds of photographs will be shown to people from time to time, and they are given, you know, some sort of a calling card or a number, a serial number or something along those lines. And that way, dependent on the division and the photograph that is shown to members within that division, one can easily track where the information came from and thus gauge the trustworthiness of the officers in that different department or on a department-for-department basis in terms of what they have seen and what they have spoken about having seen. And the gentleman who called in had said to me, you know, as a high-ranking officer formerly, I can assure you that that was not any kind of a UFO that he was shown. Who knows? You know, it almost gets into that Mirage Men interpretation of things, that knowingly disinformation is revealed to the public at times for the obvious and express purpose of not only gauging the credibility or perhaps at least presenting the apparent credibility of certain other information. You know, I've long argued this. I won't claim this argument. This has long been an argument, but one that I certainly adhere to. But I'm also a researcher who has long, if anything, I almost consider myself to be a sort of a historian, in a sense, on the nature of the belief versus skepticism debate as it relates to UFOs. And let me just be clear about something. When I say I'm skeptical, Marcello Truzzi, one of the co-founders of the infamous PsyCop, and I say infamous because at times I think they have been a little too hard-nosed about claims of the unexplained as it relates to things such as UFOs. I've got friends who are members of PsyCop. I've had professors in the past when I was in college, actually, who were members of PsyCop. But, the thing is that Marcello was one of the founding members, and I think within 2 years of the founding of the organization, he left because he felt that there were members of PsyCop, the Committee for Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, is what that group was. There were members who he felt went into investigation with their minds already made up, and hence they had a tendency toward debunking without really giving evidence a fair shake. Further, he wanted the PsyCop newsletter to present, at times, if it were justified, pro-paranormal positions on things, but other board members of PsyCop did not like that idea, and Marcello, a co-founding member, left. And at the website of Gerald Posner, another PsyCop member, and again, I think a pretty fair one and a very intelligent one, Posner includes a lot of these old dialogues, these they weren't emails, they were letters. This was back in the pre-internet days, but he had been trying to formulate a series of criteria for describing UFOs, and he had had a back and forth with Marcello. And of course, Posner was kind of a protege, as Robert Schaefer, another guy I'd like to get on this show at some point, maybe in the near future. But he'd been a protege of Philip Klass, the arch debunker of UFOs. And nonetheless, I read over Gerald Posner's designations for what he wanted to call a UFO. And very briefly, I'll get to these before I get to the next listener email, because some of this is interesting. He wrote in a letter to Marcello, "Our first objective is to clarify the term UFO, which more than merely meaning unidentified flying object, will henceforth encompass the following concepts inclusively. A. Reported aerial phenomena which exhibit sufficient strangeness to warrant investigation. B. Phenomena which, following exhaustive expert investigation, remain unidentified as any known natural phenomena. C. Phenomena which remain unidentified not for lack of credible scientific data, but despite such data. D. Phenomena which are not only unidentified, but which appear to be unidentifiable at this point in man's scientific development, seeming to exhibit evidence of an aspect or domain of the natural world not yet understood by science. E. Phenomena which often appear to exhibit evidence of intelligent control. And F. Phenomena which, rather than being exceedingly rare, are being reported frequently by many witnesses around the world." He finally notes that some of us are presently of the opinion that UFOs as defined above exist. Some of us are of the opinion that UFOs do not exist. Others of us may yet be persuaded in either direction. And the letter to Marcello goes on, but I just found this exchange to be really interesting because that was a skeptic who had written those designations for how we should move forward in redefining UFOs. I just want to ask this. Here were skeptics with PsyCop that were stating this designation, which I thought was not only very, I think, accepting of the potential for a phenomenon, but also it's a good classification system that was apparently, at one time, considered for being developed. Whatever happened to all that? In other words, there was a time prior to and during the early formation of PsyCop that there were skeptics who were good skeptics who were willing to look at data and who at times were also willing to accept that we don't have all the answers, free of a kind of bias that most modern members of, again, what some skeptics even call a social movement at very least, the modern kind of skepticism that we often see with conferences, you know, that are put on by, you know, the James Randi Foundation and the like. You know, I'm not criticizing them. I'm just saying that you have to acknowledge that that, as much as perhaps UFO belief and the conferences built around that, is a social movement. And people have asked me before in the past, they're like, you know, do you go to as many skeptic events as you do UFO events? And I'm like, well, I've got to be honest. No, I don't. And here's why. I don't have thousands and thousands of dollars to spare. And generally, when I attend a UFO event, it's when someone says, you know, we would like you to come and give a lecture. They don't always cover my expenses, and sometimes little more than maybe airfare and lodging is provided. I still try to present a very rational, skeptical perspective on all things when I attend these events. To date, I've never been invited to be a speaker at a skeptical event. Simple as that. At some point, I would love to go to more skeptical events. Sadly, I don't think that in the modern sense of skepticism, I would be treated quite as fairly as I am at UFO events where the organizers and the attendees often disagree sharply with me, but we get along really well. And for some reason, you know, and I haven't the foggiest as to why, but I continue to be invited to the latter variety of event. Again, I probably, if I had to, and I'm not trying to claim to be psychic here, but if I had to guess, my best expectation would be that in the near future I will not be invited to any PsyCop events or James Randi Foundation events if, well, perhaps with the exception that I might be invited there to be ridiculed. You know, that's all right. People can have different opinions, but I think that that's just the reality of the kinds of attitudes that people have these days, even though I often feel that my own personal perspectives might be, although more centrist perhaps, by definition, they probably go a little closer to the skeptic side of things in most instances than they would the believer camp. Not to belabor the point, Mark here writes, good show, by the way. And I wanted to drop you a note. In my opinion, if any UFO gives off heat, it's a sign of inefficient use of technology, and therefore probably terrestrial, as an advanced interstellar, interdimensional, or even interplanetary technology would be more refined. Keep up the great production. Mark M. Arizona. I would agree. If something is capable of traversing long distances, and thus capable of space travel, it probably would be a highly efficient technology. Whereas, again, the kind of heat given off by the majority of UFOs in available literature, I mean, think about them. Cash Landrum. Gosh, there's so many that come to mind. The Socorro incident. Again, that thing had flames that shot out and supposedly burned the brush right around the area where Lonnie Zamora had seen the thing when it took off. There's a lot of heat output. A lot of fire, a lot of flame. In a lot of these UFO cases, I would say probably maybe even the majority of the close encounter UFO observations over the years. And so if Mark is right there, then perhaps, yeah, these are evidence of Earth technologies. But then again, that's something that I've felt for an awful long time. Not always, but an idea I've certainly come around to. Michael finally writes, and this will be the last email we've got time to get to here. He says, Mike, I'd like to address two main issues with this letter, one being on the value of podcasting and the other relating to epistemology. Now, for those at home who are unfamiliar with the term, epistemology is merely the branch of philosophy which essentially questions, how do we know what we know? And I've said on this podcast in the past that I think that needs to be applied more rationally and frequently to the subject of UFOs. We really do need to ask ourselves more often, how much of what we think we know about UFOs is our own bias or our own dogmatism? Let's go clean slate here. How do we know what we know? Okay, so Michael continues, at the outset, allow me to applaud you on your high production value, attention to detail, and your great overall radio voice and presence. Well, thank you. All of these qualities make for a pleasant listening experience and an overall great show. Briefly, let me note also, when people compliment me on my voice, I appreciate that. Then there are those out there who will be like, you just love the sound of your own voice. To the contrary, Most people don't like hearing their own voice. They don't like the sound of their own voice. And that is one of the challenges as a podcaster, is if you're like me, as anyone really probably would be, you're a little conscious of how you sound at all times. So it can be a little challenging. Anyone who thinks that when podcasters sit down, we just like the sound of our own voice, it's usually quite the contrary. But to be professional, you have to kind of see past that and forget that you're hearing yourself talk. Now, he says, I consider you a pioneer in the realm of podcasting, especially as it relates to the 4TN and alternative thought strain. Maybe not so pioneering in the sense of being a founder of the art, but in your advocacy and quality. For someone who's always interested in learning and trying to get a better understanding of the world, podcasts and other quality audio seem an invaluable resource, maybe third only to reading and face-to-face conversation. I would agree, Michael. Now, after listening through many podcasts, I've weeded and whittled down some real gems. Mainly, these are The Graylian Report, Mysterious Universe, The History of Philosophy, Without Any Gaps, The Common Sense Podcast, and then Hardcore History, Reasonable Faith, Future Quake, Renewing Your Mind, and some others. Future Quake, by the way, is my good friend Dr. Mike Bennett's show. And Mike is, of course, otherwise known as Dr. Future on that show. But I was with Mike just a few weeks ago, actually, in Nashville, Tennessee. And he is, he is a chemist. His PhD is in pyrotechnic chemistry. But he also is the guy who had done this documentary on the Georgia Guidestones, and we had him on the show. So for those of you who aren't aware, that's the same fellow. So he says, I bring all this up, Michael says, to make an observation. It's nothing profound, but a moment, I think, of seeing the forest through the trees, that podcasting, especially some of the really great ones, may go down as historically significant. A podcast like The History of Philosophy that I mentioned earlier with Peter Adamson is a comprehensive overview of the Western philosophical tradition. With a couple hundred episodes already done and many hundreds more, I imagine, before it's completed, I would say no other similar resource on this subject exists, and this is a monumental thing. And other podcasts might be looked at in similar ways. He says, what I would like to get your opinion on is a matter of epistemology and how one is exposed to such a, or one who is exposed to such a myriad of ideas and thoughts, oftentimes conflicting ones, can come to know the truth. I reject rigid relativism and subjectivism in favor that there is objective truth. It's quite possible for there to be objective truth, and due to our human limitations, we simply cannot know or ever be certain. This would be the skeptic's position. But one cannot assume that because something is yet to be verified or unverifiable empirically, it is untrue. I find the latter to be an irrational position, and therein lies the problem. What method or means can we rely on outside of sensory experience to give us truth? Without the dogmatism that science holds today, the ancients may have trusted some other means of truth-finding that we have either dismissed or lost. Now, you might think this other method would need some verification process like science has with experimentation, but isn't that just a scientific bias creeping through? True things, especially events, can certainly be unique instances and unrepeatable. What, then, is to be said of truth dependent on verification and verified by what means? Divorcing empiricism and verification from truth can obviously lead to a number of errors, so it's unwise to dismiss these methods entirely and in all cases. What I am proposing is that outside the realm of things which lend themselves to be subject to science, there is truth to be realized and possibly a way to arrive at it. I know you've addressed this kind of issue a number of times, but I think it's worth reiterating and revisiting from time to time because it really underpins nearly all conspiracy and paranormal-related topics. Thanks for writing about that, Michael. I realize that's probably a little deep for a lot of people, and you know, even myself. Sometimes you have to sit down and read something twice, which is really kind of fundamental to philosophy, as it were. And I think that that's one of the big reasons that I've probably espoused that there is a need for more philosophical interpretation of certain UFO literature myself. Because when you do sit down and you read something one, two, maybe three times, you heard that old expression, every time you read something, you glean something differently from it. After a while, when you continue to really critically and skeptically look at things, you begin to start saying, okay, huh, this is interesting. Look at what this person said. Now, look at how I interpreted what they said the first time. But the second time, I'm thinking differently. The third time, my entire opinion seems to have changed. And then let's see what this author had to say about this incident. But then let's go back and look at, you know, at exactly what the witness had said. And then you start saying, oh, wow, well, look at this. Now we have this different statement that the witness had made, which was very clearly interpreted and kind of written differently by the author who had written the book about what that witness actually claimed happened to them. You know, I'm generalizing, but the point is when you really look carefully at all of this, you do begin to see that from time to time, language and interpretation greatly, greatly, if not impedes, colors, at very least, the way that information about these so-called paranormal or conspiracy subjects are presented. And yes, at times there may be things that can be studied that don't necessarily fall into the way that the scientific method, easily at least, and in most circumstances, can define and try and repeat and build expectations upon the nature of said reality. That doesn't necessarily mean that these things do not exist, but unfortunately I think for modern scientists, not all of them, but many, would hold that, well, that means these things don't exist. I mean, in large part, let's be clear, I think that most of the scientific community today, and certainly most, if not all, of the broader modern skeptic movement, they would dismiss UFOs based on such issues. That, well, these things, whether or not they exist, may not really conform to the scientific method. I would say right there, then, maybe these things just have not been properly studied. Maybe we're not to a point technologically where we can properly study them, but at some point we certainly will be. The modern skeptic says, therefore, these things do not exist, which I think is a very limiting view because we're not taking into consideration our own limitations technologically as a civilization. Do we really think we have all the answers? Do we really think that we're equipped with all the tools to be able to have all the answers? I don't think we are. And maybe where science doesn't stop, but maybe where the limitations of technology draw a boundary for current scientific inquiry, again, philosophy, I think, can still shed some light on those kinds of mysteries. And maybe, in fact, it should. I want to move on more specifically to the discussion of UFOs now at this point. And part of what had brought this discussion that we're going to have tonight to mind had actually been a segment in a book that was given to me by the author, Chris Rutkowski, the Canadian UFO researcher, longtime researcher. In fact, a guy, by the way, who Philip Klass had told personally, said, I think you're a really good researcher, I just think you believe a little too much of the UFO crap. The book is A World of UFOs, and back in 2012 at the First Paradigm Symposium, I sat down with Chris on the last day, and we were having coffee and comparing some notes, and we exchanged books. I gave him one of mine, and he gave me this one. And there is a entry in this book on what's called the Giant Yukon Saucer. And I just briefly want to kind of encapsulate what some of Chris, who's been a guest on the program just a few months ago, in fact, this is what he described in this portion of the book. He says, the best documented and most thoroughly investigated recent Canadian UFO case was a multiple witness event in the Yukon on December 11, 1996. The lead investigator on this exhaustive case was ufologist Martin Jasek, who has devoted much effort and expense studying the UFO phenomena in the North. Now, here's what's described. Essentially, at around 7 o'clock on December 11, 1996, four people were traveling north near the town of Carmax when they saw a group of lights in the northwest above some nearby hills. They pulled off the highway to get a better look and saw that the lights appeared to be attached to a larger object moving across the sky. There were several large orange lights in an oval pattern and dozens of smaller white lights on the main body. One witness saw only three large orange lights in a row with the other smaller lights to the right side. The object was very large, covering an estimated 60 to 90 degrees of the sky. It moved ponderously across their view and vanished suddenly after approximately 10 minutes. At the same time, in the town of Carmax, a family sat watching their television, which was positioned in front of a large window. They saw a row of lights that reminded them of a Boeing 747 jet airliner slowly moving over trees to the northeast. Three young children believed that it was Santa Claus coming early. Now, as this continues on, I mean, there were numerous people over the course of that night who also saw this thing. At about 7:30, two cousins heading for the Carmax left White Horse in separate vehicles began traveling along the Fox Lake Road. The first was nearing the Fox Lake campground when he looked west and saw a large football-shaped object with a rim of lights hovering over the lake. Now, astounded by what he was seeing, he pulled over to the side of the highway. His cousin stopped at the side of the road a few hundred feet south of the other car because he, too, had seen this thing. The first of the two cousins looked directly up at the underside of the craft, which was featureless except for a large, bright, white light in the center. The craft continued to his right and passed over the mountains out of sight. Well, they weren't the only ones. There had been a trapper who had apparently also noticed while he was carrying out his business that night, a row of lights on a large object. A beam of white light had been projected from the bottom of the object, and he said that this actually had played on the ground directly in front of him, although the object, large and illuminated as it was, didn't make any sound. There were two more witnesses that were driving north along the Klondike Highway. And later that same night at 8:30, there were around four students that were together taking a break from classes at Yukon Community College. One of them noticed some odd lights in the sky. And they all watched a horizontal row of lights move from northwest to southwest. The yellowish lights appeared to be on an object about the same size as a large aircraft that was traveling slowly and, again, making no noise. Another witness had been walking across a bridge in the area where he saw the UFO flying toward him. He was so frightened, reportedly, that he fell onto the ground as the object passed only a short distance above the bridge. A family member later verified that he was in an agitated state when he eventually got home. There were 22 people in total that the investigator, Jacek, had talked to who had said that they had seen this thing as it crossed the Yukon and Northwest Territories that night. And in such instances, what's interesting about these cases is that not only do we have something that is massive, but we have multiple witnesses. But then again, of course, as we all know, eyewitness testimony isn't worth a damn, is it? Well, what if I told you that in some of these cases, in addition to a number of people who see these large, unidentified aircraft or objects moving through the sky, maybe there has been better evidence, maybe in the form of radar, that has been presented, at least on a few occasions. When we come back from this break, we're going to revisit one of the most unusual cases, and one which involved not only witnesses that were pilots, but also government officials and their varied response to this incident, which we will pick up with here when we come back on the Graylian Report. Welcome back. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. Shout out to my buddy Luke, down under in Oz, for sending along tunes like that. Lost him above the sky. Okay, so let's travel back in time together. Trust me, I'm your doctor. 1986, it was in October of that year, and Captain Kenji Terauchi had been passing in a cargo freighter. Along with his Japanese crew. They were carrying wine, and they were passing over Alaska. As I mentioned, we did an episode of Graylian Enigmas on this a couple of years ago. Hard to believe that that much time has passed, and for those who are not subscribers, this will give you at least an idea of how the Enigmas program sounds. We'll feature a couple of segments from that longer episode, which give a great summary, I think, of what transpired on that unusual evening in 1986. And so here for your listening pleasure, one of the more ominous UFO incidents, and certainly one of great significance of the last century. And so here for you, the Japanese Airlines 1628 incident. The evening sky was clear as the jet, a Boeing 747 cargo plane, cruising at 525 knots, crossed into Alaska from Canada northeast of Fort Yukon. In the cockpit was Captain Kenji Terauchi, an ex-fighter pilot with more than 10,000 hours flight experience, along with his co-pilot Takanori Tamafuji and their flight engineer Yoshido Tsukuba. JAL 1628 entered Alaska on autopilot shortly after 5 p.m. local time, cruising at 565 miles per hour and at an altitude of 35,000 feet. All seemed well at 9 after the hour as air traffic control in Anchorage had advised them to take a new flight path. Just after the crew had straightened from their turn, Captain Terauchi became the first of his crew to observe two aircraft to his far left, nearly 2,000 feet below his altitude. Assuming they were military aircraft, he observed these objects for several minutes as they appeared to be pacing his flight path and speed.
Within just a few short minutes, the pair of objects moved to within 1,000 feet of the Boeing 747, then positioning themselves in front of the aircraft and assuming a stacked configuration. Terauchi and his crew were perplexed, if not amazed. His description of the strange aircraft remained puzzling even today. As they watched the objects, they engaged in what he later described as a kind of reversed thrust, during which he said their lights became dazzlingly bright. The objects also appeared to match the speed of the 747 while maintaining a sideways approach as if able to disregard gravity itself as well as inertia. The thing was flying as if there was no such thing as gravity, Terauchi said. It sped up and then stopped and then flew at our speed in our direction so that to us it appeared to be standing still. The next instant it would change course. In other words, the flying object, Terauchi said, had overcome gravity. Observing the strange aircraft ahead of him, the captain described feeling the heat that these objects produced within the cockpit of the 747, even at a distance, as the objects emitted a bright flare he described as a reverse thrust that would appear for between 3 and 7 seconds at a time. After observing the objects for more than 6 minutes, Terauchi and his crew had begun to grow concerned at the appearance of the objects ahead of them and decided to notify air traffic control. And yet, strangely, air traffic control operators were unable to identify any traffic in the area.
Anchorage Center, Japan Air 1628, do you have any traffic at an o'clock above?
Japan 1628, heavy negative.
Insight, we have two traffic in front of us, about a mile ahead.
The two mystery objects remained in front of JAL 1628 in this position for another 5 minutes before quickly shifting their flight orientation, then aligning themselves side by side and nonetheless maintaining this altered position ahead of the 747. The craft held this position then for another 10 minutes, moving with a peculiar, undulating motion, and occasionally bright blasts of light would accompany what looked like a back-and-forth rotation of what Terauchi described as jet nozzles, which he believed to be under some kind of automatic control. They were fascinating to him, but what, or who, could be using such advanced technology? And then there was the shape of each aircraft, which appeared to be square, consisting of two rectangular arrays bearing a glowing set of nozzles or thrusters. A central section that was of darker composition also existed, although the actual shape of the aircraft was very difficult to determine, even during those moments when the two neared a distance of within 500 feet of Terauchi's 747. He considered whether the craft might actually have been rotating, and that perhaps if he and his crew could observe more closely, the central portion actually would have been cylindrical in shape. And then, as they watched, within only 20 minutes of their first appearance, the two mystery aircraft left abruptly, heading off and disappearing into a point below the eastern horizon. Had this been the end of the encounter, it still would likely have been a notable UFO sighting by a pilot and his crew. However, the most unsettling of the events that Terauchi and his crew would experience that night had yet to arrive.
Indeed, if you can imagine things getting any stranger than that, with this particular case, they certainly did. We're going to take a very short break, but when we come back, you'll hear how various military agencies actually got involved with this. I think the CIA even had been involved in the investigation, and it certainly shed some interesting light on the feeling among officialdom at the time about this case and what it may have entailed. More about that when we return here. After this, it is the Graylian Report, as we continue our examination of unsettling and ominous giant UFO cases. Welcome back to The Place where Sumatran coffee flows like a river of wine through the hollow earth. That's right. Highly caffeinated commentators on the unusual here on this program. It is the Graylian Report. Glad to be with you as always. So picking up where we left off in the last segment, the rest of this story is, I think, truly where things start getting really unusual. And the case we were reviewing, of course, is that of the Japanese Airlines 1628 incident from 1986. Where we left off, Captain Terauchi, of course, had observed two unusual craft ahead of him. What was yet to occur was what later would be described as an encounter of sorts with a mothership, which we bring to the table here in a review of Graylian Enigmas on the incident. It was shortly after the objects had vanished toward the east, and Terauchi and his crew had continued on their course when suddenly Terauchi began to make out what he first thought to be merely a faint band of light at roughly the same altitude where the first two craft had disappeared. Whatever it was from which the light had emanated, it was keeping pace with the 747 in the same speed and direction. Engaging the onboard radar scope, they confirmed Terauchi's observation, detecting a large object near the 10 o'clock position, within just 8 miles of JAL 1628. At that time, ATC in Anchorage was notified, and while unable to detect the massive object on their radar, the NORAD Regional Operations Control Center at Elmendorf reported what they called a surge primary return after some minutes.
Yeah, that's 1-2 again. We have confirmed there is a flight size of 2 around here, 1550 squawk. One primary return only.
Okay, where is he falling?
It looks like he is, yes.
Okay, stand by.
Do you have anybody to scramble up there, or do you want to do that?
Oh, we're going to talk to your liaison officer about that.
It's starting to concern Japan Airlines taking the 360 now. Still falling.
Okay, we'll call the military desk on this.
Terauchi and his crew were notified, to which he replied that the object is quite big and that it appeared to be following them in formation.
Military radar advises they are picking up an intermittent primary target behind you, in trail, I say again. It's like a formation.
Now passing over the city of Fairbanks, Alaska, Terauchi began to see the lights reflecting off the base of this object, which appeared to be some gigantic aircraft. He estimated it to be twice the size of an aircraft carrier. Though his co-pilot couldn't see the craft at this angle, Terauchi immediately requested a change of course to attempt to evade this object, out of concern that whatever it was now pursuing them. Upon completing the turn, Terauchi and his crew were concerned to learn that the mystery object appeared to have followed them in formation, even descending 4,000 feet in altitude along with them as they completed the requested 360-degree turn. At this time, Anchorage ATC suggested military intervention. However, Terauchi, being familiar with the peculiar death of Captain Thomas F. Mantell, which occurred on January 7, 1948, declined. The Mantell incident, widely reported in UFO circles, entailed the death of a pilot who perished while pursuing a UFO. And in order to avoid a conflict with this mystery object, Terauchi also declined the offer for military intervention. Meanwhile, two commercial aircraft flying nearby were alerted of the apparent pursuit of JAL 1628 and were asked by ATC operators to approach and see if they could confirm whether they could see any unusual traffic nearby. But by this time, Terauchi and his crew also now said that they had lost sight of the tremendous object that had pursued them.
Defender 1628, have asserted your traffic appear to be staying with you. Disappears, Defender 1628.
Defender 1628, have understood you do not see the traffic any longer.
Okay.
In fact, by now, none of the three aircraft present were able to detect any evidence of a large object, as had been reported by Terauchi and his crew. Japanese Airlines 1628 subsequently landed safely in Anchorage at approximately 18:20 local time. In the days following the incident, Captain Terauchi filed an official Federal Aviation Administration report
in which he stated that the craft he observed was, for lack of any better description, an unidentified flying object. Soon afterward, Kyoto News requested an interview, after which JAL temporarily removed Captain Terauchi from duty, and then shortly afterward assigned him to a desk job. But in an attempt to garner more information, Kyoto News, as well as the New York Times, then contacted Paul Stuck, a public information officer with the FAA based in Anchorage, who confirmed elements of the story. Strangely, a number of details pertaining to the incident appeared to have been played down significantly in press reports. For instance, the January 5th edition of the New York Times carried a story with the headline, FAA Presses Investigation of Lights Seen Over Alaska, in which it stated of the incident that the pilot, Kenji Terauchi, told investigators that two of the lights were small, perhaps no larger than 8 feet across. He said the third light, which was larger, appeared to be on an aircraft. Further quoting Paul Stuck, the objects were described as, quote, wavering lights that a pilot of a Japan Airlines cargo jet said followed his plane over Alaska for nearly an hour in November. No mention of the perceived size of the craft had been made, apart from Stuck mentioning that the larger of the three objects had indeed been tracked using the weather radar on board the 747, which Terauchi had been flying that night. Citing extreme public interest in the incident, Stuck further noted that investigation of the incident had been reopened and that images on military radar screens, while dismissed as clutter at the time, did coincide with an object the FAA had observed, which had similarly been thought to be a coincidental split image of the aircraft. Despite the caution he exhibited in recounting the events of JAL 1628's mysterious flight over Alaska, Stuck did praise Terauchi's actions that evening, noting that it appeared to him it might be possible that the lights might be exhaust pipes, and therefore Terauchi's main concern had been trying to determine whether he was overtaking another aircraft. When asked about the complete circle turn that had been completed, Stuck said to the Times that, quote, it was pretty clever, and that, quote, it allowed him to eliminate any natural phenomenon which would have stayed stationary. The FAA's Alaskan region, requesting further assistance with how to handle the growing inquiries from the press, then contacted John Callahan, the FAA Division Chief of the Accidents and Investigations Branch. Callahan, at the time, was completely unaware of the JAL 1628 incident and suggested that it may have been an early test flight of the stealth bomber. But intrigued, he requested that any relevant data be sent to the FAA's Technical Center in Atlantic City, New Jersey. There, radar data, audio recordings, and other information had been reviewed, along with the production of videos aligning the radar images with the communications between JAL 1628, ATC in Anchorage, and military organizations monitoring the situation. Subsequently, a meeting held to discuss the incident was attended by representatives with the FBI, the CIA, and even President Reagan's scientific study team, which resulted in great excitement about the possibilities the JAL 1628 case might represent. But according to Callahan, all present were told that the incident was secret and that their meeting never took place. Again, as I noted prior to the excerpt of the Graylian Enigmas program that we just featured, that show takes a slightly more entertainment-based presentation, but nonetheless the facts are there, just as well as highlighting what the name implies, enigmas. And I think certainly in some of these instances we are dealing with things, whatever the circumstances may have involved, they remain at present, by description, unexplained. And I think that this case certainly is one of those. Who knows what that thing was that Terauchi actually saw? But again, this had been painted on radar. There had been people on board the craft with him who had observed this as he did. And there seemed to be a lot of interest after the fact in what that case may have involved. As a final anecdote on this one, one final piece of information I want to bring to the table. John Callahan, who had been the former head of accidents and investigations with the FAA, he had actually chimed in on this particular incident just as well. And this is an excerpt from an interview with Callahan well after the fact. He, I believe, also had appeared at the Citizens' Hearing on UFO Disclosure in Washington a couple of years back. And this is what he had to say specifically about the JAL 1628 incident.
When they asked me what I thought, I told them that it looked like we had a UFO that was up there. The reason it wasn't on the FAA's tapes was because it was too large of an aircraft, and it was picked up as weather, so we wouldn't record it. That the pilot, the Japanese pilot, seen it. The Japanese pilot drew pictures of it. Eventually, they gave the Japanese pilot a hard time because of what he said. He was embarrassing his country. Our military controllers said they seen it. Our FAA controllers said they seen it. Our FAA controllers, after a period of time, came back and said they really didn't see a target. They saw something else, which makes it sound like somebody is helping them fill out their reports, and therefore that looks suspicious. My guess is, because of the way it was, it's not part of the military's operation anymore, that it was a UFO. But who do you tell that you were involved in a UFO incident without them looking at you like you ain't wrapped too tight? And this, is the way our country is set up now. If someone comes out and says, I saw a UFO on TV, the only ones that see a UFO in the TV programs are the rednecks out in the country that that are going coon hunting or alligator hunting at night. You don't find anybody with any kind of smarts or some professional individual saying, hey, last night, let me tell you what I saw. They don't display that in the United States. So if you talk about seeing a UFO, you're putting yourself in the funny kind of a category. That's probably one reason why you don't hear about it anymore. As far as I'm concerned, I saw a UFO chase a Japanese 747 across the sky for over half an hour on radar.
I mean, you can't put it any more plainly than that. And I commend somebody like Callahan who had the guts, frankly, to come forward after having served in a position, you know, a high-ranking position with the FAA, and saying, you know, this is what we appeared to be dealing with. And here we had a former fighter pilot that Captain Terauchi had been. Now, I will also note, by the way, his response to the offer for military intervention, if you'll recall, in the segment that we featured, discussed that his knowledge of the Mantell incident had caused him not to wish to have any kind of military intervention. Of course, if you go back and review the Project Blue Book files, you'll be familiar with the Mantell incident. There are many who dispute this to this day, but I think that even Edward Ruppelt, in his book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, had noted that it was very likely that Mantell had been chasing a weather balloon at high altitude. He knew, as he ascended toward that altitude, that he would probably endanger himself because of the loss of air at that altitude, and for whatever reason, he decided to pursue what, again, in likelihood, was, in retrospect, a weather balloon in that instance. Even Edward Ruppelt had thought that that was the case. There have been many UFO researchers over the years that have tried to dispute that, but I think that it's pretty well known and on record that that is, in likelihood, what happened with the Mantell incident. Interesting, nonetheless, that Terauchi, having obviously been familiar with certain UFO literature, and at least the ufological interpretation of some, published about that case after the fact, that this had informed him in not requesting military intervention when he described what was a large mothership kind of object that appeared to be following their aircraft as they passed over Alaska that night. Talk about eerie. It doesn't get any stranger than that, but it's also, I think, in terms of information and also the government response among the different agencies, from CIA to FAA, and their interpretation of what may have happened. Yeah, skeptics, the hardened skeptics at least, may dismiss it. I don't know that it's evidence of aliens, but it's certainly evidence of something that I think we have to take seriously as the UFO subject, in the more rational cases, should be treated. Boy, there are so many more that we could talk about. And so many, in fact, I wish we had time for. Maybe we'll have to save those for the additional edition for Graylian X subscribers. For tonight, that's going to have to do it. And I remain your host, Micah Hanks, on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Headquarters. Caleb Hanks, Chris Hayes, Matthew Oakley, Jeremy London, Tyler Pittman, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Rayson Robin Hobbs. And of course, yours truly. I remain the Doctor in the Hollow Earth, Micah Hanks. Until next time, my friends, we bid you adieu. And as always, stay strange out there.
Listening to The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.